From WXXI News in Rochester, I'm Scott Feibusch, in for Evan Dawson, and this is Connections Arts Friday. Jiva Theater has been a Rochester institution for more than 40 years now, and next week it's kicking off another highly anticipated season that starts off with Monty Python's hit musical Spamalot. Backstage, there are some changes coming. Last week, Executive Director Tom Parrish announced he's taking a new job at the prestigious Trinity Rep in New England, and that means the search is underway for a replacement. Meanwhile, there's a $10 million capital and endowment campaign going on as Jiva looks to get its books fully in the black in the next 2 years. We'll be talking about all of that this hour. Joining me in studio to talk about it is Tom Parrish himself and Jiva Communications Director Dawn Kellogg. Thanks for being with us. And on the phone with us is Jiva Artistic Director Mark Cuddy. Mark, where do we find you today?
I am in my office in Dennis, Massachusetts, on Cape Cod.
Excellent. Excellent. Can we all come join you? Just do the show from there?
Anytime.
Be a nice summer location. So let's start with the season. Spamalot is, as I was saying before the show started, I got to see it in previews in Chicago before it even made it to Broadway, so I can testify that it was great even then. What's it like taking a show that is that big and bringing it to Jiva?
Well, you know, Scott, it's interesting. When we take on large classic musicals, and although Spamalot's not a classic, it certainly is a
big
Broadway hit, we have to envision it, you know, reimagine it for our theater. I mean, we have a wonderful facility, and we have a fairly large stage, but it's not a Broadway stage, and we don't have a fly system that, you know, can do a lot of things, flying scenery up in the air and down, and, you know, we have automation, and we have other things that we can do, but mainly it's a more intimate experience with 525 or so seats, so we like to do something a little different, and our design is incredibly fun and imaginative. Oh my God, the set designer and the costume designer went wild on this, and it'll be so much fun, so colorful, so much irony in every character comes out, and so we're having a ball. But it's I think if you've seen Spamalot before, it's certainly the same material, but it will have the Jiva musical imprint on it for sure.
Where does this rank among the biggest productions that you've put on there?
Well, it's very large in terms of props and costumes and scenic bits because it's very episodic. You know, it's basically a series of Monty Python bits.
Yeah.
So with every bit, there has to be something funny, with some visual that comes along with it. So while we have done The Music Man and Cabaret, and we've done big musicals, classic musicals before, that have a lot of people and certainly a certain amount of costumes, and this you have to keep topping each other. You know, the next bit has to be better than the bit before. So it has put a huge challenge for our costume shop and our prop shop.
And we should say that for anybody who's showing up for this season, that they're going to find a somewhat different experience and hopefully a significantly improved experience as they actually come into the theater. And who wants to tackle that? Tom, you want to talk about some of the renovations?
So when people come this season, they probably won't see much different. The first phase of renovation that happened this summer was on the top floor. To the rehearsal, education, rehearsal, and conference center area, and the offices, and as well as the basement in the dressing rooms and green rooms that are located there. And so, as the campaign is finishing up, we're starting design plans for the second phase of renovations, which will take place from June of 2016 to September of 2016, finished in time for the 2016-17 season. That's when people will really have a different experience coming to the theater. But I can say just what has been done so far is mind-blowingly transformational, and the artists have been over the moon.
Tell me a little bit more, and Mark, if you want to chime in here as well, how does this improve the experience of actually putting on a show?
Well, for the artists, their facilities are really top notch, and I would put them up against any facility in the country. I mean, they're beautiful, with between the new artist housing located next to the theater, and the new dressing rooms and green rooms, the artists feel like Rochester really cares about them, and that's what we were going for in this renovation. And the rehearsal hall alone, and I can let Mark talk about that, is transformed, and it's more versatile for a lot of other uses. But as a rehearsal space, it's first class.
Yeah, it really is. And this was Spamalot was the first show in there, and there's new flooring, there's new ceiling, new lighting, new curtains, new sound system, new everything in there. I mean, it's the same footprint, but everything within it is new entryway, new doors, new glass, new mirrors, new. So it feels so much more focused. It's more comfortable. The flooring is a lot more comfortable for the actors on their feet. Because the whole reception area right outside the rehearsal hall and the kitchen and everything has been redesigned as well. It flows beautifully. People, you come up to our top floor where our offices are and our rehearsals are, and you feel it's a place of creativity and it makes it a big difference. So our Spamalot cast, while they're working hard, they feel as if they are in top-notch facilities, as Tom has said. And you know that the word travels fast. We cast out of New York, of course, and that's because that's where all of the professional actors reside. And that word travels, you know, about housing and about facilities and about rehearsal. And you know, we have a great staff, and we've always had a great supportive audience. But now we have, and you know, let's be frank, we're in Western New York with long winters. And to pull people out of New York City for 2 months to work on a show, it has to be a really good destination for them. And they're taking time out of their personal life and their careers to come up and work with us for 2 months if they're an actor. So we need to take really good care of them, and we have to be better than other theaters to attract these people.
I've got to imagine at this point, though, you know, seeing who you've brought up here and seeing what the reactions to them have been. I mean, you've got to be going into those casting sessions with a pretty good reputation behind you.
Well, we have a great reputation for our quality and our staff, and you know how we treat people and what our community is like, and we have really good attendance. But frankly, it's still getting top people to come out of New York City, as opposed to staying there and having them just do auditions or doing shows there and doing commercials there or the TV spot here and there. You know, we're always trying to ratchet up and get better and better people. So we have very good people, but you got to keep going. You're only as good as your last show or your last season in the theater. So we have to keep pushing forward.
That's funny for me, having grown up here and remembering when Jeeva was still across the street and the Armory was sitting there sort of semi-abandoned. I still kind of think of the Armory as being Jeeva's new building. Of course, you've been in there for, what, 30 years now?
30 years. Yeah, and the building's going to have its 150th anniversary here in 3 more years. So yeah. It's been getting up there in age.
What are some of the challenges when you're working with a building that is that old with trying to put modern facilities inside of it?
Oh, well, you never know what you're going to find. We didn't find anything too exciting in this. You know, the construction workers were all excited because when you work on an old building, you start taking walls down, you find really interesting things in the walls, whether it's a Coke bottle from 1910 or something. And they didn't really find anything like that, but it's really what was really interesting, I think, once we stripped out the old walls that were put in 1980 when we moved in, was seeing all the various scars and uses from prior uses, because the building has transformed many, many times over the years, from our arsenal to convention hall to armory to government offices to horse stable to all these different to hospital. It's had many functions.
I was going to make you see the pictures of it with the mansard roofs on it.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. I mean, it has such a storied history. And then, and where you can really see it, I think, the most is in the basement. And you can just see the old foundations and where the additions were put onto it and how various structural elements were reinforced. And in the basement, we exposed a lot of that. We left all of the stone pilings. We exposed them. We exposed all of the big, huge wood beams holding up the first floor. So you really get to see that. And we talked about, when we were doing the design and work on the building, what to do about the scars. And we chose to leave them because that is the history. And so you can really see that history come through.
Yeah, it's a building that Jeeva is very proud to inhabit and has been for 30 or more years now. And it's a building we take care of. We love to take care of it. It's our home, and it's the gateway to downtown, so we're very proud of it.
Are there or will there be tours available if people want to see the innards and what you've done there?
We do once a year have an open house called Magic in the Making. This year it's it's on Martin Luther King Jr. Day in January.
January 18th.
Yeah. Marking that in my calendar.
Yeah,
right now.
And then... for our donors, we also do First Friday tours. So anyone who makes a donation can come to one of those tours and get a look around the building. But Magic in the Making's great. It's free, open to the public.
Yeah, absolutely.
And all of our staff is on hand, sort of at their battle stations, so to speak, to talk about what they do and how they do it.
Sounds like the open houses we do here about every 2 years or so.
Right.
Yeah. But with more history to see in this case. It is Arts Friday on Connections here on member-supported public radio. I'm Scott Feibusch in for Evan Dawson. We are talking in studio with Dawn Kellogg and Artistic Director Mark Cuddy is on the phone from Cape Cod. Tom Parrish, Executive Director of Jeeva, is here with us in studio. We want you to join us as well, if you can, 844-295-TALK, 844-295-TALK. 8255 is the phone number. I am on Twitter at Scott Feibusch if you want to throw a question in that way. And since we've talked a little bit now about the renovations, let's talk a little about the funding behind them. You've got a $10 million capital campaign that is underway. Where do you stand right now? What's the progress, and where do you still need to go?
Well, we're well over $9 million at this point on the campaign. And so we have a couple $100,000 left to raise to be able to finish all of the capital improvements that are scheduled for next summer, which include the addition of entertainment suites on a new mezzanine level, the redoing of the entire lobby and box office and cafe into a full-service bistro that highlights Finger Lakes food and beverage, and then the two theaters themselves will receive new flooring, and then the Wilson stage will receive new seating.
So that how does this compare and kind of put it in perspective, particularly as we'll talk about in a moment, with your upcoming move? How does this compare to other regional theaters? What else are they going through, and where does Jeeva fit in?
Well, most of the building boom, most theaters in the country did their big campaigns and building renovations maybe 10 years ago. And so our campaign started in the quiet phase 5 years ago, and this has been the largest capital campaign in the history of Jeeva, and with the largest before this being, I believe, $4.5 million, which Mark can verify. So this has been the largest campaign for Jeeva, and really the work has been overdue. When we started doing the capital projects, the building was literally crumbling around us and the audience. The audience didn't know that there were buckets over their heads while they were watching the show catching rainwater and running it through tubes to bigger buckets backstage that had to be emptied out each night when it rained. And the bricks were crumbling and all the windowsills are granite and those were cracking. And the winters were exceptionally hard on the exterior of the building. And so that's where we had to spend the first bit of time working before we could come inside.
And the seats themselves, I understand?
Yeah, the seats are 30 years old, too, and we are out of spare parts. And so so I'm sorry if your seat's a little broken. We're band-aiding it together as best we can until the new seats are installed next summer.
So this is the next piece of this then will be next summer. And when people come in, in the fall of 2016, you said they're going to experience a new lobby, a new cafe. What are some of the other differences that they're going to notice?
They'll experience a whole new level. So when people walk in the front door, it'll be a one-story entry that will open up into a two-story vestibule, and there will be entertainment suites that can be reached by a grand staircase that will be in the lobby. The box office will be more front and center when you walk in, and that sort of entry space will be much more open. And then the ceilings will be taken up higher to their full two-story height for much of the sort of concourse in front of the two theaters, exposing more of the brick. People will have, it'll still have intimacy, but also highlight the verticality of the space and integrating the historic elements. It'll feel warm and inviting, yet contemporary at the same time.
Were you limited at all historically by what you could do to the building?
Well, interestingly, we were certainly for the exterior. Interestingly, the interior of the building, most of it was built in 1985 when Jiva moved in. It was a convention hall. It was a giant open space. So the actual audience chamber was built by Jiva, and all of the walls inside were built by Jiva. So most of what we're touching is not historical fabric. It's all 1980 mm-hmm. fabulousness that
is being... lots of mauve.
Yeah.
844-295-8255 is our phone number. We are talking about the new season at Jiva Theater, and we are talking to Executive Director Tom Parrish here in the studio. And, of course, by the time all this happens a year from now, you're going to be in Providence because you've just announced that you're taking this very exciting, very prestigious new job. For people who don't know about Trinity Rep, talk a little bit about Trinity Rep and what this means and why this is a big deal for you.
Trinity Rep's one of the preeminent theaters in America. It's one of the oldest. It's 52 years old, and it's a Tony Award-winning theater and is the state theater of Rhode Island. Structurally, it's very similar to Jiva with two stages, a slightly larger budget than Jiva. And Trinity's also has an affiliation with Brown University, and Trinity runs one of the top three actor-director MFA training programs in the country. Also different is Trinity has a resident company of actors. So there are 16 actors who live in Providence and are cast in all of the shows. And so that's the model of theater. Actually, Jiva started with a similar model of a resident company. And most theaters in the country have moved away from it in favor of casting on a show-by-show basis. Trinity has one of the last long-standing resident acting companies.
Certainly an exciting opportunity. It's easy to understand why you couldn't say no to it. What are you going to miss here?
I'm going to miss the theater. I'm going to miss that I don't get to see the finished renovation, certainly. And it is bittersweet in many respects. And the wonderful people that I've met here and the relationships that I've formed with people. Everyone's been so welcoming and allowing me to be part of the Rochester community, and that's been enjoyable. And so I'll miss that. So if anyone's in Providence, they're welcome to look me up. And
absolutely, I can certainly recommend going to Trinity Rep and seeing a production there. It's well worth it. Of course, your New England is home for you, so this is.
I came from New England before Rochester. I didn't grow up there. I actually grew up in the snowy regions of Buffalo and Southeast Michigan. But it was an enjoyable place to live, and looking forward to connecting with all of the friends that I made there when I was there.
Mark Cuddy, what's it going to be like to lose Tom from your end?
Well, you know, we never say goodbye in the theater. We always just say see you later, like when a show ends or that sort of thing. And you know, we're a very small national community of professional theater leaders. We really are. Tom and I had a great mutual respect and had a we've you know accomplished a lot together and a great partnership. And you know, I'm excited for him. I don't want to lose him, but excited for him. And you know, it is as you said, it's bittersweet, but he's not that far away, and again, our community is
especially
small,
from Cape Cod.
Exactly, it's only an hour and a half from where I am right now.
Until you hit traffic on the Bourne Bridge, in which case it could be.
So you know, I think you know our paths will cross, and again, because that's the way we all work together in this nonprofit professional regional theater movement.
Yeah, I mean, I think just a funny story that Brian Lilienthal is the lighting designer for Spamalot, and he's directing or he's lighting designing Oklahoma at Trinity this spring. So as all of our paths cross, it is a very small world in the theater, and we will all see each other again, I'm sure.
I can tell you it's like that in radio too, very very much so. Some of these, I mean, obviously you've got the capital campaign well underway. You've got an endowment campaign that is getting where it needs to be. What else do you point to as some of the accomplishments that you're going to walk away from here remembering the most of?
Well, I'm especially happy about the new artist housing that the actors are living in. I think it worked out really well as a way to integrate the artists into downtown Rochester, bring them closer to the theater, and provide them really with first-class accommodations when they're living and working here for the 8 or 9 weeks that they're in Rochester, and the apartments are beautiful, and so I'm really happy about that. I'm happy about how the finances of Jiva have turned around in many respects, and the organization's on a much stronger foundation. While still not quite to breaking even on an operating basis, it is the company is generating positive cash flow and will continue to do so, and that's really been just to the generosity of the community and to the audience who have been diligently and generously increasing their donations every year. The donations at Jiva have climbed significantly over the past few years and really helped to bring some balance and diversity to both the finances but also balance and diversity to the art. Because the box office, we won't die by the box office like we maybe would have a few years ago. So there is the opportunity to fail. And one of the core values at Jiva is that we take risks for the opportunity to do something astonishing. And you can't take risks if failure is not an option. And so I think, you know, you just see some really cool artistic stuff happening that you know, maybe couldn't have happened before, but now because that foundation support is there, it can.
That's exciting. We will continue our conversation about Jiva in just a moment. We are talking with Dawn Kellogg and also with Tom Parrish, the executive director who is soon to make his way off to Trinity Rep in Providence here in studio, and artistic director Mark Cuddy is on Cape Cod. Your questions as well at 844-295-TALK, 844-295-8255. Coming up right after this quick break here on Arts Friday on Connections from member-supported public radio.
I'm Evan Dawson. Monday on The Next Connections, it's Labor Day, and we follow up a discussion on the local labor movement with a question on, is it really that easy to fire employees who are not members of unions? A local employment attorney offers her perspective working on cases for years. We'll talk about the state of at-will employment and much more. Talk to you Monday on Labor Day on Connections.
This is WXXI AM Rochester, WRUR FM and HD Rochester, WEOS FM and HD Geneva, and WXXI FM HD2 Rochester.
Dissatisfied with the U.S. Border Patrol, former Texas Governor Rick Perry made this pledge.
If Washington won't secure the border, Texas will.
State troopers have been on the border for 14 months now.
The bottom line is the job's getting done, whether it's the guys in the tan uniforms or the Border Patrol.
Operation Strong Safety later on All Things Considered from NPR News.
That'll be 4 o'clock this afternoon on Your member-supported WXXI AM, your NPR news station.
Coming back.
It is Arts Friday on Connections here on WXXI, WRUR, and WEOS. I'm Scott Feibusch in for Evan Dawson. We are talking in this hour about Jeeva, about the Jeeva Theater Center, about the construction that continues to be underway to make the experience there a little more comfortable, both backstage and also for people showing up for shows. And we're talking about the new season that is about to get underway with Spamalot, which starts in just a few days. On the phone with us from Cape Cod is Artistic Director Mark Cuddy. In studio with us, Don Kellogg, and Executive Director for the moment, Tom Parrish. And I think before we jump into the new season, just to sort of wrap up this piece of the discussion about Tom and his future, what happens now from Jeeva's end? What's the process that you're engaged in now in terms of finding a replacement? What kind of time frame are you looking at?
We have our board of trustees, of course, is engaged to do this. Richard Gray, one of our vice chairs, is chairing the search committee, and it'll be seven people on the search committee made up of trustees. And I will sit on it as well, and we're about to hire a search firm that is one of the two national reputable firms. And we will, over the next 2 months, see candidates. One of the benefits of having some success, a lot of success over the last 4 or 5 years with Tom here, is that we're in a better position, not only financially, but with the renovations and everything. We have a very attractive position for someone here. So we will have no shortage of good candidates who are experienced and ready to take on this challenge. We don't know how long this will take, but we suspect before the snow really starts falling, we'll have someone hired.
It sounds like this will be an exciting process for you, and I hope...
It always is, yeah. You know. It's actually, you hate to go through it, but it's a good process for an institution to go through, and you learn a lot, and you get other perspective, and you get candidates coming in to give us their perspective on Jeeva and its place in the national community. It's a good time to get a little perspective.
I imagine it has to be an interesting role to come into, and Tom, maybe you can speak to this a little bit too, coming in right after a big campaign like this has done most of its work, when a lot of the strategy presumably is now set for at least a few years. What then becomes the role of that next person?
Well, I think one thing that the board has started talking about is we're now entering the fourth year of a five-year strategic plan. So this plan of revenue diversification and deepening and upgrading the infrastructure at Jeeva, all of that has been moving along and is nearing completion. And so it's right at about the time for the next strategic plan to be talked about. And so the board's been talking about, so now Jeeva is strong on many fronts, and we're in a market that is not necessarily growing. So how does Jeeva as a company grow? And so I think that that'll be an interesting opportunity for someone, is to grow and find new ways of new and bigger and better ways of serving the community.
Exciting. So having talked about enough that's going on backstage, let's segue to what's going to be happening right on the stage. We've talked about Spamalot and about how you're starting off with that. Mark, if you want to kind of lead us through some of the rest of what people can expect this season. You're going from Spamalot into Mark Rothko in red.
Yeah. It's we're known for the variety on our stages. We have two stages, the Wilson stage of 525 seats and the Fielding stage, 180 seats. And we have a huge range. So we go from Monty Python Spamalot to on the Wilson stage, the larger theater, to a play called Red, which is It's about Mark Rothko and a young assistant, and it takes place in his studio, which is a sort of vast high school gymnasium turned into his work studio. And you see painting happening. You see pulleys and big canvases, and it's a very exciting. And it's, you know, it's Rothko in a period of time where he's being challenged by younger artists. Where he set the tone for so many years, now he's being challenged, and it's a fabulously theatrical drama, and then we start the Fielding studio series with a show that was a huge hit in New York off Broadway, a huge hit in London, and it just started a national tour. Here in Massachusetts at the Merrimack Theater, where Sean Daniels, our former artistic associate, is now the artistic director, and it's called The Lion, and it's a one man and five guitars, and it's his story, his family story, and it's unlike anything you've really heard. I mean, it's fabulous songs and stories, and his incredibly charming, engaging, emotional journey. But very uplifting at the end, and it's been a real sensation. So that starts in November. So again, just the fall, three hugely different kinds of shows, and then our Christmas Carol, which is now a huge tradition.
Sure.
And it's a version that I adapted and directed, and has original music by Greg Coffin. And every year, our audiences go, "Oh, it's better than even last year. You know, you've changed it." Well, we tried to tweak it a little bit every year, but it's something that people can count on. And you know, when you do a holiday show, you really want something that you feel like you know what it's going to be. And this version has lots of music. It has video. It has great special effects. It's a ghost story of Christmas, which people have been flocking to. So,
I'm struck by something that Tom said earlier about having the ability to take the risk of failure and to be able to try different things. I guess that's bolstered by having surefire things like Christmas Carol and Spamalot. Obviously, is you know that's going to do well. And you got Eugene O'Neill coming in the spring. What are some of the riskier pieces of this season? What are some things that you're looking at and saying, "Wow, I don't know how this one's going to go."
Well, you know, there's different kinds of risk, Scott, and I would say that Monty Python's Spamalot was not a slam dunk because it's so costly. It's such a huge production that if it didn't hit at the box office, we'd be in big trouble.
Right. Well,
so it has happened to have a huge event, and I think we're going to do very well with it. It's the performances are already selling out, but we weren't sure, you know. I mean, it was we bit off a certain amount there. In terms of the material, Eugene O'Neill is now, frankly, that is a risk for us because the classics, whether it's American classic or world classics, don't get done by the professional theaters now all that often because audiences don't necessarily respond to them as much as they used to. So digging into a drama, A Moon for the Misbegotten, which is a gorgeous romantic drama, is a bit of a risk for us. And then ending the Wilson stage, we have a new comedy that's really fun and savvy, and it's an office comedy, but it's an unknown. We'll be doing only the second production of The May Queen. But it's written by Molly Smith Metzler, who is a SUNY Geneseo grad in the year 2000, and she's carved out a New York playwriting career, and she writes really sharp, funny comedies. And so that'll be really fun, but no one really knows that. So that's certainly a risk. And over in the Fielding in February, we're doing a play entitled An Iliad. So it is a telling of the Iliad, but it's a retelling. It's a reimagined way of telling it with one gentleman called the poet. And he contemporizes not only the language of it, but brings in other wars and offers comparisons to the original story and what civilization has gone through in the hundreds and hundreds of years since that story was first told by Homer. So it's something very different, and so that's a risk.
Well, you're coming off another event that was, I guess, somewhat risky going into it too, which was the celebration of Sun House that just wrapped up. Which I was telling Don before the show started, I was out of town and missed most of it. But the responses I've heard were all phenomenal.
It was extraordinary. We created Journey to the Sun, a celebration of Sun House, a four-day immersive with videos and audios and lectures and performances and workshops and exhibits and food and music. It just was amazing 4 days. And we also unveiled a blues marker from the National Blues Trail that is over in Cornhill in the corner of Clarissa Street and Gregg Street, which is a big sign that pays tribute to Sun House and Rochester. And it's the only one in New York State. It's only one of 14 that are outside of the South, north of the Mason-Dixon line. So it was a real tribute, and it was a city community event. We did have people from 13 states come to take part in the event, participate and attend, but it was a celebration of our community here and what impact Sun House has made. It was really extraordinary.
Yeah, and from Turkey. We had someone come from Turkey, too.
Yeah, exactly. Who knew? Sun House is big in Turkey. But we had people come. Yeah, it was, and there was no roadmap for this. It was something we had never done. No one had ever done it like this. It certainly have been music festivals, but this wasn't just music festivals. It was there were academic things done. It was a real four full days of the blues.
Well, I want to ask you, the whole landscape of the arts in Greater Rochester has changed so much since Jeeva started in 1972. What sort of relationship do you have? What sort of relationship do you want to build with some of these newer pieces that have shown up? We've got the Fringe Festival that's getting underway shortly. We've got the Jazz Festival, which has become such a huge thing, basically right down the street from you. Every spring, where does Jeeva fit into this growing arts community in town?
Sure. We're one of the anchors downtown. I was a founding board member of the Fringe Festival. The Fringe Festival performances happen in our fielding stage, our 180-seat theater over the 10 days. It's very important and it pushes the envelope creatively, which we love. We're the largest professional theater in not only in Rochester, but in Western New York. And it's nice that through a creative festival like the Fringe Festival, other smaller performances that really push the envelope can happen. And we all support that for sure, because that, those might not be appropriate for the Wilson stage or, something in our subscription season, but they're very important to the ecology of performance in Rochester. And there's a new artistic director now, Danny Hoskins, at Blackfriars, and we're real supportive of them. Ralph Marento does a great job over at JCC Center Stage. We're a good community, and I think a supportive community.
So do you coordinate when you're trying to figure out what the next set of shows is going to be for upcoming seasons? Do you talk to some of them and figure out to make sure that you're not conflicting?
Yes, we do. We talk among ourselves because Jeeva is professional as well as the largest. We actually get the rights first to some things that come out of New York. So Ralph or Jack Haldubas at Blackfriars now, Danny, will give me a call. Say, are you planning? Is this on your list? Is this something that you're planning to do? And I'll say, be honest with them. Yes or no. No, go ahead. You take it. We talk with each other a lot.
Can you drop any hints? What's on Broadway or off Broadway right now that you're looking at? Thinking, 5 years from now or 4 years from now, I want to get this here.
I will start thinking about next season this coming month, but that's about all I can do. No, we don't. You know what? We adapt so quickly and we evolve so quickly, and the theater is so ephemeral that we try to hold off and not plan too far in advance because things change so quickly. I'm evading your question.
Actually, kind of fishing for what's good down there that we should all go see right now.
There will be something this fall that will happen that I'll go, okay, fantastic. You know, let's get in line for that. But I can't tell you what that is right now.
All right, Mark Cuddy joining us by phone from beautiful Cape Cod, Massachusetts, where I think we would all like to be on this lovely Friday afternoon. Don Kellogg here with us as the communications director at Jiva, and Tom Parrish will kind of let you get the last word in here. What, both inside or perhaps outside of Jiva, what are you going to miss most about Rochester when you head off to Providence?
Oh, goodness.
You can't say Wegmans.
Yeah, they've got that in Massachusetts.
I'm not the shopper in my household.
Okay.
So I
might never have left Boston if I knew they were coming.
All right. It's a beautiful place, and there's a lot of history here, and just the water and the landscape, and being close to my family and in Buffalo, I'll miss that, and and as I said before, all of the people that I've met and gotten to know and built relationships with here.
All right, well, good luck to you as you're in your new position at Trinity Rep. When do you actually leave?
My last day at Jiva is October 31st.
Okay, so you'll get to at least stay through the opening of the season.
Yep.
Thank you so much for joining us. We have been again talking about Jiva here on Arts Friday. And we turn our attention now to the newsroom. Randy Gorman, our WXXI news director, joins us right now as we come up on the anniversary tomorrow of another devastating day in our community, the day 1 year ago when developer Larry Glazer and his wife Jane Glazer, a local businesswoman, both philanthropists, died in a plane crash in the Caribbean. And Randy, you just talked to Ken Glazer a short time ago.
Just talked to Ken a little while ago, as you'll hear in the interview. Just not ironic, but it, similar day to today. Tomorrow's the actual anniversary, but it was a Friday. I remember being in the newsroom and people here, a lot of people who knew the Glazers, stunned by seeing what had happened with the plane, of course. And I talked to Ken not only about that, but really looking forward to all the changes that have been going on at Buckingham, even though they've got the same vision. They've got some exciting things going forward. And let's hear that portion of that interview right now with Ken Glazer.
I'm sure it's not only a terrible event, but probably not an easy year. As we make the one-year anniversary, obviously your thoughts are about your parents, but, does it feel the same way it did a year ago? We're speaking on a Friday. I mean, a lot of similarities in the day, in a way.
Yeah, no doubt. Today is a very, very fascinating day mentally, because it was a Friday. It was a sunny day, just like this. The time right now is when things were starting to really become real. You know, it was about 11:30 for me, where it dawned on me that, you know, they're not coming back. And, you know, to be a year later, it's really surreal. You know, there were points this year where I was able to actually sort of settle down, accept what it is. And today sort of brings up a lot of those emotions back from a year ago. But, you know, they are still so close to me. Mentally, it's I can't believe it's been a year, and I think most people share that sentiment that they were such big parts of so many people's lives that they're not going away. Their memories are really stuck in me, and they're not going to disappear, and I don't think they'll ever disappear. But you know, it's been a year, and I swear it's like yesterday I just spoke with them.
You are managing partner at Buckingham, obviously a huge responsibility, company which is involved in so many downtown projects, you know, not the least of which are the Midtown Tower redevelopment, Xerox Tower, Legacy Tower, which used to be the Bausch & Lomb building. When you certainly had to take some time to grieve, but so many of these things were going on after, you know, it became evident that, again, they had died in this crash. Did did you really, really have to kind of get back into the business angle of things very quickly?
Yeah, I guess quickly is making it is being polite. we couldn't afford a downtime. The whole concept of Larry not being at being the leader of this company was something that we quietly discussed for years. What would we become? And with the banks, the projects, the partners, and the general confidence in this company, which we have so much going on and so much of the city rooting for us to do well, not necessarily because of us, but because it's the city and it's getting rebuilt. And we were one of certainly the leaders of that charge. I think my father, certainly in his own right, was maybe the most prominent fan of the city. And he took things on when a lot of people didn't.
I'm curious about this, and we've all, obviously we've all lost, a lot of us have lost parents or close relatives, and your father was such a big force in that company. Even though, again, you're your own man, you do things a certain way, do you still hear your father's voice as you make different decisions?
I'm someone that tends to talk to myself anyways, and I have lots of conversations with my dad. A lot of them, I sort of yell at him for doing this to me and putting so much, not necessarily on my plate, but everyone's plate, my whole family. And not that he did this intentionally, but he's nice to have to sort of talk to. And, Larry and I had a really nice relationship and we think very similar. So I think a lot of instincts that I have, he would have had, or vice versa. So, to answer your question, yeah, I talk to my father a lot, and I talk to my mom a lot. I don't want her to be forgotten here, because she had her own thing going, and her own business principles were a little different than my dad's, but they were obviously very good, and she really took the family approach to a company. And
you should have the catalog company, QCI Direct.
Yeah, yep.
And I've read some interviews, and like you say, I've heard she had a different style of management, but still very successful.
Yeah, they did things very differently, and I've gotten to sort of absorb that for years, seeing two different ways to approach business and both being successful.
It's hard to sum up a person's life or both your mom and your dad's life, but how would you think people in Rochester should think about them as they're thinking about them a year later? How should they kind of remember them, if you kind of sum that up?
More about the community and the philanthropy. The business for my father, it was great. He loved it. But it was all about making the community better. I mean, even those projects that he was doing, in the end, it was helping downtown get rebuilt, and it was what he cared about.
That's Ken Glazer talking about his parents, Larry and Jane, who died in that plane crash a year ago. I do want to mention, Scott, we got a statement from Mindy McLaren, who's Ken's sister, speaking on behalf of the family. She said, "We would like to thank the community for their support and concern throughout the past year. We truly appreciate all the posthumous awards and honors given to our parents, which allowed us to share in proud moments, counterbalancing the very sad ones. We feel lucky to be part of such a generous community." And she also wanted to emphasize, Scott, how much they miss their parents. I mean, as you heard Ken mention, they are so incredibly busy, all of them in various projects. But certainly when you lose your parents and lose them, especially in that way, there's a big hole in their lives as much as it is in the entire community.
Absolutely. What's happening? You mentioned the interview with QCI Direct. What's the status now of that?
Haven't heard of any big changes. I know they're still going on, and someone in the family had pointed out to me, and I spoke to Peter Lovenheim yesterday, and we'll have some of that interview for you later. Really, Jane Glazer had started to move away from the company she founded. She was still CEO, I believe, but there is a president of that company, so I think she was starting to back off a bit. I mean, they are still doing what they were doing the catalog retail business.
I should mention, the interest of disclosure, that I'm a member of the family, and so
you're a cousin related, right?
My mother and Jane were first cousins, mm-hmm. so this is obviously a difficult week for everybody involved, and I certainly echo what Ken said about how it does feel in some ways like it was just yesterday.
And they've had a, you know, we had the, which we're still looking into, the fire on top of the apartment building, Buckingham Commons last week. We were talking about that. And, I mean, you know, he seemed remarkably, I wouldn't be as composed, but, he, you know, it's been a heck of a week for them. And, of course, today and tomorrow, I know they're having some private remembrances. But, you know, it's a lot to go through. But, again, he really wanted to emphasize the fact they are looking forward. And they still see, they're very invested in this community. And still see a very big future for not just downtown, but the entire Rochester area.
Well, it kind of fits into to pull together the conversation we were having earlier in the hour with Jeeva about the importance of keeping the entire downtown community growing. You talked at greater length with Ken Glazer. That interview is going to be available in full a little bit later on our website.
Right, WXXINews.org, and we'll have some excerpts later today. We had some interview segments from Heidi Zimmer-Meyer earlier from the Downtown Development Corporation during All Things Considered. You'll hear some of that, as well as a conversation, parts of it that I had yesterday with Bob Morgan and Morgan Management, very important part of some of the big projects the Glazers were involved in, and he also devastated by what happened. But again, he said they built enough of a succession plan, or at least have been able to kind of move forward despite their grief and dealing with everything else involving the plane. They are looking forward to really having a big impact on the skyline here in Rochester.
It's certainly a reminder of a very difficult week in this community between the Glazers and then Officer Pearson.
It's Officer Pearson the same week, and for folks who don't remember that, it was a horrific week here. But hopefully we will move on stronger from that.
So we will hear more about the Glazers coming up later on All Things Considered and at WXXINews.org. Thanks to our guests earlier in the hour from Jeeva as well. And thanks also to John Andrus behind the board as our producer and to Evan Dawson. I'm Scott Feibusch in for Evan Dawson here on Connections. Evan will be back Monday right here on member-supported public radio.